On this week's 51%, a feminist pioneer shines a light on the lesser-known women who helped achieve women's suffrage.
We could shout out the names of these women and men who supported women's suffrage, who worked for it, for a few days if you have the time.
And hear about a new education program to help women living in poverty. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. The story of women's suffrage has been told in the same fashion for some 100 years, but now influential writings, speeches, and reportage are assembled in one place with an emphasis on the unsung heroes that shaped and established the movement. That one place is a book called The Women's Suffrage Movement. It's an intersectional anthology edited by Sally Rush Wagner, with a foreword by Gloria Steinem. Sally Rush Wagner was awarded one of the first doctorates in the country for work in women's studies and founded one of the first college-level women's studies programs in the U.S. Dr. Sally Rush Wagner has taught women's studies courses for 48 years. She currently serves as an adjunct faculty member in an honors program at Syracuse University in New York. She is a member of the New York State Women's Suffrage Commission and a consultant to the National Women's History Project. The Women's Suffrage Movement features the writings of the most well-known suffragists, such as Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, alongside accounts of those often overlooked because of their race, from Native American women to African American suffragists like Ida B. Wells. 51%'s Joe Donahue spoke with Sally Rush Wagner and asked her how the anthology came to be and what it was like to edit.
Well, the process came to be out of my frustration at there not being an anthology that really was comprehensive about all of the issues, and it didn't start with white women, and it didn't deal with the really difficult issues of the movement and the problems. So when Penguin asked, what would you like to see in an anthology? I told them, and they said, that's what we want, will you write it? So the process of putting it together was about, almost 50 years I've been studying this area and really going to the primary sources. So the process was one of choosing in difficult ways which of the incredible number of wonderful sources to put in the anthology.
Just give us a little bit of a perspective. When you started your career in academia, women's studies did not exist. And then you were awarded one of the first doctorates in the country for work in women's studies. What happened during that time, and where have we come from that moment as you entered the equation?
I think that we're in the process of a revolution, and it has waves. It comes and goes in terms of the movement activity. It never ends, but we're continuing the work, and we're continuing the work that our feminist foremothers had begun in the suffrage movement. And in the 1960s and 70s, we didn't know that they had dealt with the issues that we were still dealing with. Equal pay for equal work, violence against women, reproductive choice, all issues that were on the front for women 150 years ago, women activists.
One of the elements of the book is the emphasis placed on primary documents. There are speeches, letters, and excerpts from various retellings of the suffrage movement. Give us a sense of why you think those texts, those historic texts, are so important.
Typically, when we read history, it's the historian saying, well, this happened and this happened and this person said this and this person said this. The primary sources allow us to hear directly from the people, and it's an access into history in a very intimate and immediate way.
You have studied this for so long and have worked with so many greats, and I guess I'm interested in what led you to an anthology versus writing a straight nonfiction historical account.
I think it is the opportunity for people to decide for themselves. You know, as I introduce each of these sections, I sort of lay the groundwork, and then at the end, I come to my conclusions. Those conclusions may be completely different by the reader. And when you have the primary sources, you have the opportunity to make your own judgments about what's going on and what it means.
One of the things that comes out fairly clear is the suffragists knew a lot about history and feminist history, even in 1860. And you argue perhaps even more than the second wave feminists of the 1960s.
I think so. They knew that women had voted in the colonies when property restrictions and qualifications were the deciding factor. We didn't know that. The suffragists said, we're not asking for a new right. We're asking for the restitution of the right to vote that our foremothers possessed. We had no idea that was the case. We didn't know that they were dealing with all these other issues. And we didn't know the history of, for example, the women that influenced Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Matilda Joslyn Gage, Lucretia Mott. They all had contact with Native women. And these were white women who had no rights to themselves. Once they married, they became literally the property of their husbands. The two shall become one, and the one is the man, and women became dead in the law once they married. So they had no right to their bodies, to their children. Husbands could will away an unborn child. They had no right to any earnings they had. Anything they brought into the marriage became their husband's. They knew Native women who had had political voice for 1,000 years on this land and still have it. They knew women who had rights to their own property, children being through the female line, and I think this sparked their imaginations, said, you know, that which we're told is not possible is we're seeing it right in front of our eyes.
One of the things that you critique in the book, and it is fascinating, when we think of these icons like Susan B. Anthony and Carrie Chapman Catt and Anna Howard Shaw, they, in their pursuit of suffrage, you report to us that this was often at the expense of women of color. How do we reconcile that? How do we put that into a context, which obviously context is something we're still struggling with today?
I think it's exactly what we're dealing with today. When racism is present in somebody's behavior and their actions, what is the accountability they have and what action do we take? I think we don't have a model for how to deal with that historically. We've made icons of these founding fathers, of the founding mothers of the movement, and we don't know how to judge. You know, how do we judge George Washington and Jefferson and their enslavement of human beings? That's the same issue we face with these women, because they, toward the end of the movement, began to make the argument, give women the vote because white women outnumber Negroes and immigrants, and woman suffrage is a way to maintain white, native-born supremacy. Now, how do we take accountability for those actions? They allowed the Southern women, the auxiliaries in the South, to segregate, to work for Jim Crow laws, and to work for the vote for white women only. That's a legacy that continues today, and it had effect. African American women and men really didn't have the vote until the 1960s, when the Jim Crow laws were overturned, the voter suppression laws. We're still having problems with voter suppression today. So where is that place of accountability? I call for a truth and reconciliation process where we tell the truth about the problems of these women that they caused that we continue to have today. And I think until we do that accountability, we really can't celebrate, because not everybody's at the table for the celebration. The women who really didn't get the right to vote because of the actions of the suffragists, partly.
To further that, you make the point in the book that this is a moment when we can take a critical look at hierarchy itself. How do we begin to do that?
Well, I think part of the way is the way that we look at the past. What we've gotten in the past is the great men, great wars, great dates, and the beginning of women's rights history followed the same process. We looked at these iconic women and said they were what made the change. They weren't. It was a movement. And I think breaking that hierarchy historically is part of the process where we say, no, Abraham Lincoln didn't free the slaves. It was the abolitionists that pushed him to finally take that measure. And I think that understanding that power really resides in the people, and we have the possibility of bringing the world forward or through our inaction, just having it stay as it is. And I think that sort of history empowerment that comes when we break down the hierarchy of understanding our past is a process of democracy we really need.
We certainly learn a lot from the successes of our foremothers and even our forefathers, and you make the point that we have to learn from their mistakes as well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The contributions of Native American and African American women were certainly overshadowed by their white counterparts. Give us a sense of the involvement of women of color in the movement and why it was so important for you to highlight those voices, those marginalized voices, when putting together this anthology.
Well, I think part of the hierarchy is that we believe that history began when white people got here, and that's often the way we tell the story. Women had political voice on this land 1,000 years ago. The Haudenosaunee, Iroquois Confederacy, those women really inspired the founding mothers of the movement. We also have marginalized the African-American women and men who fought fearlessly for the vote and all the other issues. Issues that were common to white people and black people, but also the unique issues that the blacks were suffering at the time. Lynching, for example. The woman suffrage movement made no position on that, in no way supported Ida B. Wells in her work to end lynching. But African-American women were working for suffrage, even when they were segregated, even when they were not allowed to be part of the National American Woman Suffrage Association in some of its chapters. They were organizing on their own. But before then, there are so many women. If we actually date the women's movement from 1832 and the formation of women organizing into female anti-slavery societies, it's Boston and it's African-American women who organize. The female anti-slavery societies were African-American and white women. And abolition and women's rights were absolutely combined. So we have entire families. We have the Fortin family. We have the Ramond, Charles and Sarah Ramond, a brother and sister who were suffragists and abolitionists. We have Mary Ann Shad Carey, the first African-American woman to edit a weekly newspaper in North America. She goes on to recruit. She comes back from Canada, recruits soldiers for the Civil War, African-American soldiers. She goes on to get a law degree. She is this absolutely brilliant, fascinating woman who is also a suffragist. So we could shout out the names of these women and men who supported women's suffrage, who worked for it for a few days if you have the time.
It brings up an interesting point. I made a note as you were saying it earlier, though, when you think of who we thought of for a large part of our history as the icons of the women's suffrage movement, and we had those names, and as you pointed out, some of their actions were imperfect. So when we look to today as to the leaders and who is fighting, should we focus more on the movements themselves as opposed to individuals?
Absolutely, Joe. If that is the conclusion that people come to when they read the book, I would be absolutely delighted. It is a movement. You know, I've been with my friend Gloria Steinem, who wrote the foreword.
Yes.
When, you know, just in formal situations, a woman came up to her and said, Gloria, I am so grateful to you. You turned me into a feminist. And Gloria said, you know, I appreciate that. Thank you. But I was just a public worker in the media. The real work was done on the ground by the grassroots movement.
She says, Gloria Steinem writes in the foreword of this book, that the movement was both a miracle of shared purpose and a tragedy of division. Mm-hmm. What do we learn from that?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the takeaways I take is the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, you know, that time period after the Civil War. Slavery was abolished, and so how could we change the Constitution? Because the Constitution was a slavery document. Enslaved people were considered three-fifths of a person for the purpose of determining representation in the House of Representatives. So we've got to change that. We've got to change the Constitution. Well, the abolitionists and the women's rights advocates came together, formed an organization to fight for universal suffrage. Open the door of freedom, and the African American and the woman will march through it arm in arm, one of the newspaper publishers said. So this was a moment when we could have had a democracy moved way forward with everyone voting, all citizens. Instead, the radical Republicans who were in charge of Congress said they had control of Congress, and they said, sorry, we're only going to let one of you go through, and that's going to be African American men. And they divided that coalition. I think that being aware of and watchful of that divide and conquer by those in power is something to really be watchful for.
Okay, speaking of radical Republicans on the right, what do we do as we come into the 2020 election, do you think?
Well, of course, we have the dream of having finally a woman president so that we're not such a terrible embarrassment in the eyes of the entire world. We are so far behind. We are, I think, what is it, 75th in terms of 192 countries in terms of the number of women that are in political office. So I think that, you know, this is a dramatic moment when we can really move the agenda of freedom forward. And taking that opportunity for 2020 would be my dream.
So the question is, it does come down to what is good historically and what makes sense. And then also, well, Democrats will say, but we have to beat this guy. So can those two things be met, do you think, or do we have to have that discussion?
Well, I would love us to have the discussion about expediency, because I think we operate our political system on the basis of expediency, and over again, we may win the battle, but we lose the long-term war. That's what happened with the suffrage movement, and I'm a firm enemy of expediency. I think that it may take longer, but the infrastructure is strengthened if we're looking out for everybody at the same time and not being willing to, you know, let somebody go by the wayside or some issue go by the wayside.
That was Sally Rush Wagner speaking with 51%'s Joe Donahue. She is editor of The Women's Suffrage Movement. A number of U.S. senators have reintroduced an Equal Rights Amendment. The 20 Democrats and one Independent did so at the end of March, the close of Women's History Month. The ERA would amend the U.S. Constitution to guarantee women equal rights under the law. Currently, the Constitution does not contain explicit protections for women. The ERA states, quote, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." The ERA establishes within the United States Constitution the unambiguous and unassailable rights of women under the law, end quote. Alice Paul wrote the first version of the Equal Rights Amendment in 1923. Paul also founded the National Women's Party and was considered a key figure in helping to pass the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. The Equal Rights Amendment passed Congress in 1972, but fell short of the 38 states required for full ratification by three states. The reintroduced legislation is led by U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey. Co-sponsors include a number of candidates seeking the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. A community college in New York has received a grant to help women in Ulster County who are living in poverty get an education, skills, and more for gainful employment. I spoke with SUNY Ulster's Mindy Cole about the program set to kick off in the fall. Mindy Cole is Associate Dean for Adult Learning at SUNY Ulster.
So we started looking at some of the data, and we were stunned, and maybe we shouldn't have been, to learn that there are 12,000 women in Ulster County who live under the poverty level. And additionally, 40% of Ulster County lives, you know, just at the survival level, which is huge. It's a huge number. And that one third of the children who live in the city of Kingston are living in poverty. So we said clearly there was a need to do something to try to help, you know, all these women.
She and her colleagues endeavored to figure out how to remove as many barriers to success in a college program as possible for women living in or near poverty.
It's based on community partnership. It absolutely will only be successful with a lot of community partnership and collaboration together, because SUNY Ulster can't do all this by ourselves, you know?
She says reaching underserved women has its challenges. Community partners, therefore, include a number of sectors, and she describes one.
We're also starting to work with the houses of worship, because the pastors and the other religious leaders in our community, you know, will know or be able to identify within their population women who might be successful in this program and are poised to, you know, take this step to change things and to get, you know, an education along with all these wraparound services.
The New Start for Women program recently received a grant from the Novo Foundation to help with its launch. It's seeded by a $100,000 donation from longtime SUNY Ulster supporter Darlene Pfeiffer.
The educational piece to this will be a one-year certificate in general management to start. So this is a newly approved one-year certificate that we have here at SUNY Ulster. We developed this certificate with the help of community partners, and it's the basics of, you know, general business skills that would then be able to lead someone to an internship and then, you know, a job in a business or in an organization in our community. And the certificate actually has an internship as one of the requirements.
In addition to general management, the program will add administration office skills and entrepreneurship in subsequent years.
We have four business certificates in the business department. The fourth one is accounting computer skills, which is expertise in QuickBooks and Excel, which is so needed in the workplace today. So, yes, we're starting with general management, and then we're going to expand it because this is a three-year pilot.
She says the program will offer a number of support services.
Childcare, you know, a computer. If our student doesn't have a computer, even internet access. If the student doesn't have internet access in her home, lots of career support, workshops, dress for success, how to take an interview, how to write a resume, even admission to our Own It Entrepreneurial Women's Conference that we run here at SUNY Ulster so they can connect with other successful women. Support groups, lunchtime support groups, and family events at the Kingston Center to, you know, where we're running this program from our Kingston Center, you know, to build community and relationships among our cohort of students.
Cole talks about enrollment numbers for the program that begins in the fall of 2019.
We are going to seek to accept only about 12 because we want to work very closely with these women on a daily basis, pretty much. We want to make sure that we understand all the barriers to success and help them, you know, issue by issue, problem by problem. It's going to have a lot of intensive advisement, a lot of support, and a lot of support from our community partners. Then the second year will go to 24, and the third year to another 24, and then from there.
Cole gives one example of what would help render the program successful.
We want to build an alumni program so that successful women can come back and help future women who are in the program and serve as role models and mentors for those women as well.
The $1.5 million Novo grant will be dispersed in $500,000 increments over 3 years. All U.S. women getting mammograms would receive information about breast density, which can sometimes make cancer harder to spot. This is under a government proposal released March 27th. The Food and Drug Administration's proposed rules would standardize the information given to millions of women following scans to detect breast cancer. Some states already require the notices. More than half of women over age 40 have dense breasts, with less fatty tissue and more connective and glandular tissue. That tissue appears white on X-rays, the same color as growths in the breast, making mammograms harder to read. Dense breast tissue is one of the factors that can increase a woman's chances of developing cancer. Under the FDA's proposal, all women would receive a short summary about their breast density. For those with dense breasts, the letter would note that their tissue makes it harder to find breast cancer and could require additional testing. The letter would also recommend that they speak with a doctor about their individual situation. Regulators say it was the first proposed update to national mammography standards in more than 20 years. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1550.